Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Tonight's show was taped live on Sunday night at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. I moderated a panel called Come Home America. Come Home America is an anti-war movement that's working to create a dialogue between left and right, between the progressive anti-war movement and the conservative writers and activists who oppose the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. Both groups sit outside and are locked out of the mainstream conversation in America's media. It's a decidedly anti-Obama as it was an anti-Bush conversation. So what you're about to hear is a dialogue, as I said, that I moderated, Busboys and Poets, in Washington, D.C., between those who believe the right and the left should come together to end the wars. And we strive to bring all kinds of voices to our program, the popular and the unpopular, the outsiders in our political conversation, as well as the usual insiders. So I invite you to listen and respond to me at mark@steinershow.org with your ideas and comments, and chew on this, which you hear on the air today. The guests in the panel are consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader, conservative political writer Kelly Vlahos, progressive activist Kevin Zeese, and editor of the American Conservative, Daniel McCarthy. First, we have to turn this over to WEAA traffic, check on the roads right here in Baltimore, Maryland, and then we'll be right back with the second hour of the Come Home America panel.
My name is John, and I'm glad that this is taking place. My question is oriented towards the long-term view of how we should be looking at going into the future with our electoral system. One of the things that concerns me greatly is just declining civic participation rates. It's concerning that single-digit turnouts are showing up in the polls. I think a lot of people are just turned off by, like has been mentioned, the choice between bad or worse. And, you know, it keeps a lot of the people that would otherwise be holding our system up from showing up to the polls. So I wonder what the panel's sentiment is on where we can best, start to reform this system. Is the two-party system, do we go around it? Do we reform it from within? Do we scrap it all together? What do you think the most realistic reform measure would be going forward, long term, for the young guys?
You know, it's interesting. Today there are demonstrations throughout Europe, 150 demonstrations around Europe, 50 in Spain. The top demand of the Spanish demonstrators, which is not getting covered through the fog, the forces of greed are not telling you about this European revolt that is building on the Arab Spring. Now it's the European summer. Their first demand is end the two-party system in Spain. They face the same issue we do, a manipulated democracy. So I think Ralph's work on breaking through the duopoly is going to be remembered much more as a legacy than the seatbelts are.
The question you just asked, I'd like to push a little bit harder, what you're trying to ask the folks up here.
Wait, Ralph.
Yeah. The question is this. Everybody, at least the two of you on this panel, I know we'll always push. We have to push a third party. The Democrats and Republicans are bankrupt. You got to do away with the Democrats and Republicans. You have to find a third way, another way of doing things. But let me ask a question about what I think the spirit of what you're asking is. What's the reality? The reality is you have in this country the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Inside the Democratic Party, you have progressives who in the school. I know you're rolling your eyes at progressives, but progressives in the Democratic Party, they're there. Kucinich is part of them. Conyers is part of them. You have people in the Republican Party who are Tea Partiers, who, as well as folks who are against the war, and you also have the neocons, the neoliberals, in both parties who support the war and support the corporate structure. That's what most people in America relate to. People in America relate to Democrat and Republican. The last time we had a split in America was the 1850s when the Whigs blew up over slavery, and created the Republican Party that seized the White House in 1860. So, and that was a divided election, four-way election, where nobody had an absolute majority. So the question is, I think what he wants to, what is, for his generation and everybody else in America, what is the reality? And the reality is we face a system in America where people relate to Democrats and Republicans, or they don't relate at all, and they just take a walk.
So that's what most people do.
Yeah. So, that's why I'm asking to push his question a tad further.
First of all, look, we can think of all kinds of solutions to change the situation.
But it all comes down to civic motivation. You got to make people angry enough to break their routine, to get out to the polls. So first you have an issue that will really stir people up. There's never been a national debate on mandatory voting. The first debate that's going to reach a national audience will be on June 27th here in Washington, D.C., and it'll be debated on both sides. Is mandatory voting patriotic or is it undemocratic? Civic duty applies to jury duty inferred from the Seventh Amendment of our Constitution. Our Constitution is full of rights, only one duty. One duty, jury duty. Question is, if freedom is participation in power, as Cicero defined it so brilliantly over 2,000 years ago, then we've got to have more people participating. The two parties thrive over a lot of people who might challenge them, not voting. That's one. The second is, a third party that gets 5 to 7 to 8 million votes and is viewed as damaging one party compared to another, major party, will begin supporting the John Conyers and the Dennis Kucinich inside the Democratic Party, for example. Or if it's from the other side, a libertarian one that gets 5, 7, 6 million votes, especially in key states, that will support the people inside the Republican Party, like the Ron Pauls and the Walter Joneses. That you basically take the Electoral College, which should be abolished, and you use it. One thing about the Electoral College is that if on the margins a party thinks on a major issue they're going to lose Ohio or Pennsylvania because of a winner-take-all, then the people who are trying to do the right thing in the party will be strengthened from the outside. But there's no substitute for rallies, marches, gatherings all over the country. Half of democracy is showing up. The reason why Nixon signed so many bills into law that he never wanted to, EPA, OSHA, Product Safety Commission, wanted to change the drug policy, is because he felt the rumble from the people coming out of the 60s. So it all comes down to turning the video player off, turning the TV off, going into the neighborhoods, going into the town halls, and starting it from the bottom up. So we cannot excuse the people in this country who've given up on their democracy, given up on themselves, given up on their future for the most trivial and ridiculous of reasons. And the reasons are that they don't think through what is happening as a result of their withdrawal from the political electoral process in their own self-interest.
Dan?
Well, let me raise a structural problem as well here, though, and that has to do with the sheer size of the electorates we're dealing with in contemporary United States. There was a time when, local elections and local powers were much greater than they are now, and I've heard Ralph, speak very eloquently about this in the past. Not only, state powers, but also the powers that localities had. And because of the way that, the Constitution, especially the Reconstruction Amendments, were interpreted in the late 19th century, awarding corporate personhood and generally doing a lot of things to restrict the powers of states to actually have an economic impact on people's lives, that form of participation has been closed off. And that's doubly difficult, actually, because as a result, it encourages people to try to get involved nationally. But nationally, you're just one vote out of, more than 300 million at this point. So one of the things we have to do is restore some sense of scale and proportion and devolution to our political system. One basic idea, which is something that would only be getting started now, but is something that really needs to happen, is increasing the size of the House of Representatives. We need to really chop up these congressional districts so that you're not just one vote out of 500,000 or one vote out of a million, but you're actually one vote out of a much smaller electorate. If you look at other legislatures around the country, around the world, if you look at the British House of Commons, Britain is a much smaller country than the United States, and yet the House of Commons is much larger than our House of Representatives. This sense of scale, as well as hopefully at some point an ability to restore localities to a sense of prominence in our political system, these are two structural things which are going to have to change in order to reinvigorate self-government in the country.
Well, just to talk about a movement that is working recently, if you look at the, the Ron Paul revolution, I mean, looking at it from in the conservative community or conservative world here in Washington, it's very remarkable to see the scope and range of that movement evolve since, you know, the beginning of the 2008 election. It took place on the internet. It took place in communities. They raised millions of dollars for Ron Paul. Millions of dollars sometimes in one day where they'd have these money bombs and the word would go out on the internet virally and they would just raise gobs of money. And not only the money, what did the money pay for? The money paid for getting Get Out the Vote, organizing grassroots organizations within communities and colleges and all over the country. So they were able to turn out people at events that other candidates weren't turning out. And for a great example is the Conservative Political Action Conference. 2 years running, Ron Paul won the straw poll each time. Now, this is a conference that has been dominated by your, you know, rock rib Republican, Reagan Republican conservative base, socially conservative, fiscally conservative. But these were the people that were behind George Bush for two terms running. Next thing you know, you have libertarians dominating the tone and the tenor and the debate at CPAC. Why? Because they bust in hundreds of Ron Paul students, supporters that came in. And what were they doing? They're having cool parties. They're passing out literature. They were there to vote. I sat there and watched as Don Rumsfeld was booed on the floor of CPAC this year. This is unprecedented that there would be any of this division, much less somebody of his stature being booed at CPAC. And why? Because the libertarian contingent was out there because they were playing outside the box, outside the rules. And it was done with money, you know, and I'm sorry to say, but it was done with money and just communication that went beyond the major mainstream media.
Can I say a little quickly?
Oh. I suppose I said no.
I listened to you.
Yeah, right, go ahead.
People should not waste their vote on candidates they don't believe in. You've got to listen to these candidates, like we listened to Obama and saw he was going to expand wars, expand militarism. We saw he was going to put in place a corporate health insurance scheme that enriched the insurance companies rather than confronted them. We saw he was advocating for the Wall Street bailout. He was obviously a corporate militarist, and people who wasted their vote on him, thinking he wasn't, were fooled. Don't be fooled. Don't vote against your own interests. Vote for what you want. As Eugene Debs said, who ran for president 5 times, he said, I'd rather vote for what I want and not get it than vote for what I don't want and get it. Too often, Americans vote for what they don't want, and we get it. It's time to delve an independent political movement, and that starts with voting for what you believe in, and it actually starts organizing and mobilizing people. So I'd recommend people go to October2011.org. That's an effort to mobilize people in Washington, D.C., to bring a Tahrir Square to Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. this October. October2011.org. Let's get people mobilized.
Margaret, are you out there with the mic? Then we've got to come back. You haven't had your question yet either, so go ahead.
My name's Jonathan.
Oops.
Hi, my name is Jonathan, and I was wondering if the panel will comment on the relevance of the deficit crisis or the fiscal crisis and the debt crisis and inflation on a possible motivation for people to finally start taking part in determining policy, especially, you know, spending overseas and interventionist foreign policy.
That's a good question, as we tried to get to a little earlier as well. That is, to me, the crux of it for most people. Dan,
well,
go ahead.
You're seeing it already on a superficial level. If you watched the last Republican debate about a week ago, you saw that Republicans were suddenly channeling a much less interventionist spirit than they had previously felt. And it's because they understand that their own constituents are starting to get worried about the expenditures. And they realize, too, that for all the reputation Republicans may have as people who want to slash the welfare state, they're going to get hit a lot worse electorally. And they've seen that things like the Paul Ryan plan are just not very popular. If they try to tinker with the welfare state, they're going to get in a lot more trouble than if they try to cut the warfare state. And so a lot of them, for purely selfish reasons, actually are beginning to look at what's going on in foreign policy. And you see a lot of panic about this from the neocons and the war hawks. So, for example, just today, John McCain was going on the talk shows, the Sunday talk shows, warning about the return of the Buchanan wing of the Republican Party. You've seen the Wall Street Journal was hysterical about what they were calling Kucinich Republicans, the Republicans who were voting for Kucinich's plan to end the war in Libya. So you're starting to see a little bit of this pressure bubbling up, but we need to see a lot more of it, and we need to make sure that the pressure kind of increases, that this isn't something where people can get off the hook simply by saying something in a debate that they never follow up on. There needs to be a real pressure here, and that means a real movement to force these politicians to do what's right.
You know, sometimes the trim tab strategy is the best. Two little laws would change the situation, and try and poll them. The first is, anytime our government is going to plunge our nation into war, there would be a statute on the books that would be triggered, and all children and grandchildren of statutory age of members of Congress will be instantly drafted. See, then you will see congressional hearings, you will see observance of Article 1, Section 8 on the Declaration of War, you'll see witnesses, you'll see media, you won't see the party line of Bush and Cheney. Very simple. And who can be against that? It doesn't even cost anything. There's no appropriation. The second one is simply to say that no members of Congress will have any benefits unless all the American people have the same proportionate benefits. That's health insurance, for example. So I raise these because sometimes we think too hard and we come up against huge mountainous obstacles. And sometimes it's good just to, what are the simple trim tab levers on those 535 that will bring them to their constitutional duties and bring them to their deliberative senses?
Well, Kelly, go ahead, then we'll go back to the audience.
Just to tack on to what Dan was saying, the biggest difference between the Republican debate the other night and what we saw during the 2008 campaign was the treatment of Ron Paul. I remember watching the debates, 4 years ago, and they were vilifying him. I mean, we had the American Conservative had a cover of Rudy Giuliani. It looked like he was about to slap Ron Paul down, I mean, physically, because he basically called him out as a fool for his interventionist policy. And here's, Rudy Giuliani, he's got the whole 9/11 thing, and he thought it was just appalling that, Ron Paul would suggest that our foreign policy had anything to do with the 9/11 attacks. Fast forward 4 years later, when the country is actually reflecting this concern and this angst about the economy and the jobs and everything, and after Ron Paul's, tremendous showing, not only in the polls electorally, but just in the media and the support, and you see that he has affected the Republican agenda in ways that we would have never imagined, where they're talking his talk, they've co-opted his ideas and his tone on the Federal Reserve and the deficit and the war. And so what a difference these 4 years make. They have co-opted. Now where will they go with it? 4 years ago they weren't even giving him a speaking role at the convention. They weren't even letting his delegates seated. They skipped right over him. So is this political expediency that we're seeing here, or is this a real true sea change?
It's not a sea change, because look what they did to Gary Johnson.
Yeah.
They kept Gary Johnson, who's a kind of a Ron Paul-like candidate, from even participating in the debate. So they're stuck with Ron Paul, but they're not going to get stuck with another one. And imagine if you had Gary Johnson and Ron Paul up there echoing each other on these war issues, you'd have a different kind of debate even then. As to your question about deficits, there's no evidence right now that we're seeing any signs of inflation. There's none. Even though there's a big deficits, and that usually leads to inflation, that's not the problem that's driving people right now. What's driving most people is the issue of jobs, underemployment, the inability to make ends meet in their own lives, and then the shredding of the social safety net. Those are the issues I think are driving the population much more than deficits. Now, that may change if deficits start to produce double-digit inflation, like they did in the Carter administration. Well, that may change the political dialogue. Right now, I see the deficit dialogue being driven by Wall Street and the leadership of the two parties, and not by the people at all, except for maybe a tiny fraction of the Tea Party types, who I just see as mouthpieces for corporate America. They not even know it, but they're tricked into that position. So I don't see the deficit as being a driving factor right now. I think the real factor right now is a stagnant economy that's not going anywhere, and the lack of investment in that economy by business and government is going to keep it that way, and that's going to be the election issue.
Well, I mean, here you do see a genuine left-right divide. I think for many on the right, especially myself, you know, the Tea Party is a very complex movement, right? You do have people who are Ron Paul libertarians, who are non-interventionists of other kinds, and then you also have people who have no foreign policy coherent views at all. You have people who are interventionists, but all of them are actually really upset about the deficit. They're really upset about lots of forms of government spending. So on the right, this really is something that has a pulse. And now, you know, that doesn't mean that other issues such as unemployment are unimportant. So they're critically important to everyone. But certainly there is a constituency for talking about the debt and the deficit. And one of the things I should mention here, by the way, about the relative opportunism that we see in the Republicans right now sort of modulating their approach to foreign policy that we may have seen in the anti-war movement under Bush when, you know, they were more anti-war then because a Republican was in the White House than they are now with a Democrat. I think in either situation, as opportunistic as some of these things might be, they provide teachable moments for those of us who try to be consistent. And so we can go and try to present show the continuities between Republican and Democratic administrations in foreign policy. Right. And show, I think of a book like American Empire by Andrew Bacevich. The title of the book might lead you to think that it's by some radical lefty or something, but in fact, Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Bacevich is a conservative Roman Catholic. He's a former military guy. His son served in Iraq and was killed in Iraq. And Andrew Bacevich is someone who comes from a very conservative background, and yet who has written this wonderful book. It was published in 2001 called American Empire. He's written a number of other books since then on similar themes that basically shows how through the Bush years, George H.W., through the Clinton years, and then into the beginning of the George W. Bush years, you have had a thoroughly consistent foreign policy that has been, you know, against American interests for all the reasons that Ralph mentioned, that this is a policy that is both immoral, that's unaffordable, and that really actually deteriorates our strategic position in the world.
That word empire. Yeah.
Folks, can we go back to the audience?
Just one quick. I wish the right would be more specific when they attack the deficits. They're far too general. If you take away the wars and cut the Pentagon budget down, and if you didn't bail out Wall Street, there'd be far, far less deficit. So, and it makes a difference. What's causing the deficit? It's the plutocracy. It's the war machine that's causing this deficit. It's not ordinary workers. And also, as has been said in the past, if we had corporate taxes at the level they were in the 60s, which were quite prosperous, there'd be no deficit. So we have to ask ourselves, someone goes to work and makes $60,000 a year and is paying 25-30% income tax. If somebody on Park Avenue just clips coupons and pays 15% on dividends, 15% on capital gains, that's crazy. Income is income. It should be in the same pot. But that's draining the revenue source as well. Right. So I wish that the dialogue would become more specific and not so general as we've seen, notwithstanding Fox News.
In the front row.
In spite of the War Powers Act debate and whatnot, Congress at the same time, right, going on right now, is in the process of expanding the... Congress is in the process of expanding the authorization for the use of military force, which also includes expanding the use of military commissions even for domestic terrorism. And a huge expansion, just like the Enabling Act in Germany, 1930s Germany, going on at this very moment while they're having this sort of meaningless debate about war powers. Also, in regard to Ron Paul, yeah, he was sort of a phenomenon, but yet who's recognized now as the leader of the Tea Party, one of the most militaristic people in Congress, Michelle Bachmann, who absolutely worshipped President Bush for his war making. So it seems like there's a real genius on the part of the militarists to be able to co-opt every effort being made. So as far as a tactic, and considering all the tremendous consequences to this country. And if you get out of Washington, D.C. and get to the Midwest where I'm from, people are really hurting, you know, and everywhere else in the country outside of D.C. Having read in the pages of American Conservative, Lieutenant General William Odom before in the run-up to the Iraq War, calling it the potentially the greatest strategic disaster to this country that there ever was. And I think if you look at the relative change in status now between, say, China in the United States strategically, and not saying they're an enemy, but merely a competitor with us, obviously there's been a tremendous change to where now they're getting to where you could almost call them the world's sole superpower, at least economically. So perhaps it's time to paraphrase a 1960s book, None Dare Call It Treason. Perhaps it's time to begin saying it's time to dare to call it treason. If you look at the effects that so many of these militarists have actually had on our strategic position in the world, how could they have done this unintentionally? I mean, you could ask rhetorically, if they did not intend to commit treason. If you look at the effect, the harmful effects that has occurred to this country. So maybe it's time the anti-war movement stops stressing, you know, their peace basis and whatnot, and begin calling these people out as traitors. Because if you look at the effect on this country, it's far greater than anything that Elder Hiss, I think, even could have contemplated in doing to this country. But it's been done these last 10 years because, and again, who wanted this country to get involved in these Mideastern wars? Well, nobody other than Osama bin Laden, which is commonly known now. So these people actually enabled Osama bin Laden to accomplish his objective. So what is that but treason? And it's time to begin calling it that, perhaps.
Kelly, let me start with you.
I think there is a disconnect between what in the inside the Beltway knowledge of all these illegal machinations that have been going on in the 10 years and what the major mainstream media has been providing in terms of information. I mean, and the greatest example of that is, you know, this WikiLeaks, the WikiLeaks revelations. Tens of thousands of documents have been revealed to us, the American people, and how many people have actually paid attention to it? The crimes that have been committed in our name over in Afghanistan and especially, you know, Iraq, you know, just one nugget is the fact that there are more civilians killed by U.S. troops than that they ever let on. They said they weren't taking body counts, and they were taking body counts all along. Has anybody held the military accountable for that lie? No. We are the corporate media has basically stunted our information flow. And therefore, people aren't talking about the legal issues in this war. What's going on with this expansion of military, the Military Authorization Act? Nobody's talking about it. And therefore, everything's been reduced to this bumper sticker slogans about what Mr. Nader said about the deficit and why people are against it or why people are against the war, because they're not talking about the legal issues, the nuts and bolts of why we're there and what's been done to this country in our name.
I think, you know, a lot of words are not allowed to be said, and treason might be one of them. And when you're talking about accusing our military of treason and looking at the WikiLeaks documents and seeing what's been done in our name as an example, I think the word that really is taken off the table, that's kept out of by the fog, the forces of greed, is the word empire. Dan mentioned it in Bakovich's book, American Empire, but that's a word that's not allowed to be used in the media. We don't see ourselves, we don't describe ourselves as an empire, even though we're probably the biggest empire and one of the longest lasting empires in world history. You can go back to the 1890s and the Philippine War as kind of the modern onset of it. But, you know, we have an empire that is gigantic. I mean, over 1,100 military bases and outposts. You compare that to Rome and Great Britain at their peaks had about 35 each. And so we're much bigger than previous empires, and yet most American people don't even know we're an empire. And an empire economy is not working for the United States for most people. It works for those who benefit, that small percentage, who benefit from war and militarism. Smedley Butler said, Smedley Butler is that most decorated Marine in U.S. history, who served from the 1890s to the early 1930s. And when he left, he described war as a racket. A racket meaning a small percentage know what's going on and everybody else is lied to and doesn't really know what's going on. The people who are being lied to are the ones who pay the price. We pay the price in bodies, in deaths of relatives, and also in dollars, while those who know what the racket are profit from it. That's what American empire has been. It's been, and he described himself as a racketeer for big business. That's only become more true today. And if, you know, the reason when that's kept out of the debate, it results in people not understanding why we're in various places around the world. If you take Afghanistan, to understand Afghanistan, it's not about Al-Qaeda. That's not even an issue anymore in Afghanistan. Our own government says there's less than 100 members of Al-Qaeda in the country for our 100,000 troops to be fighting. Need to look at a map. What is near Afghanistan? What does that position the empire for? Well, we owe $2 trillion to China, and that's a nice launching pad for not paying that, to being the Sopranos and saying to China, we're not paying that back. And we got missiles pointing at you from Afghanistan. It's right next to Pakistan, near Iran. It's a globally positioned, and then, of course, you look at the resources under the soil in Afghanistan, $1 trillion of precious metals, and so close to the Georgian natural gas. I mean, so there are reasons to be in Afghanistan, but we don't get told the real reasons, and so we don't have a real debate about why we're there. Is it worth the $1 trillion in resources? Is it worth the positioning so we don't have to pay China back for the loans they've given us? Is that a good reason to be in Afghanistan? Let's have a debate about that. But instead we get this debate, phony debate, about Al-Qaeda and women's rights and all these things that are really not what the war is about. You go from war to war, and by looking at this as empire, understanding it much more clearly. And that, I think, is a war we got to get back, put back into the debate. In fact, we had, at Come America, we had a private 40-person meeting to test out the idea of whether right and left could work together. And one of the issues that came up was whether the word empire was something people on the right and left were both comfortable with. And we found across the spectrum, we were all comfortable talking about the United States as a world empire. And that's something you don't hear in the fog. The forces of greed prevent us from hearing that very important reality.
And the lessons of history is that empires eventually devour themselves.
That's what's happening.
They devour themselves. Even mighty empires like Rome, they devour themselves. It comes right back on them. And it's very important to know that the major technique of the militarists in this country after the fall of the Soviet Union is to vastly exaggerate the criminal attack on 9/11 as being one of a huge global organization that's suicidal, hates us, and can't wait to destroy us. That was completely false. This was a criminal gang that had no second act, and that, unlike Bush's assertion, had no sleeper cells here, suicidal, violent, well-resourced, and ready to destroy us. But we had to exaggerate it in order to justify all these invasions and all this military budget. And it was Douglas MacArthur in the late 50s, who, at the end of his life, who said that the military always exaggerates threats to America in order to increase budgets. That's General Douglas MacArthur. But in this case, it was the neocons and it was the civilian apparatus that really started the exaggeration. Just note one thing. This is one of the most inept criminal gangs that has taken the world stage. After 9/11, this so-called massive gang trying to impose a world caliphate, the three times they threw their people against the U.S., they were utter volunteer amateurs, fizzled in the shoe bomber, fizzled in, on the way to Detroit, and fizzled in Times Square. They were not trained, nothing. They were volunteers or demented or pathetic individuals, lucky for us. But it does illustrate that this was a vastly exaggerated gang to provide the pretext for all kinds of misadventures and expenditures. $1 trillion overreacting to 9/11 by exaggerating Al-Qaeda. And the final test was just May 1st, when you had the leader, presumed leader of Al-Qaeda. He was living in an unguarded compound with walls, had no arms, no booby traps, nothing. From A to Z, this was not a major military threat to the most powerful military in the history of the world. And it's going to happen again. We're going to exaggerate some gang and develop into some organized theory of massive attack against us in order to keep expanding budgets, expanding military business, and as a byproduct, curtailing our civil liberties and civil rights and destroying our economic prospects.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're going to take a very short break. And then we'll be back with more from our Come Home America panel, taped live at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. on Sunday night. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center. providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Tonight's show was taped live on Sunday night at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. Now let's go back to our discussion. One of the things we haven't, several things we haven't mentioned here. One is that there clearly is a switch in how the United States of America, the government, wants to handle the issue of security. You see the switch going on between the Department of Defense and the CIA and who's going to head what. That it may in fact happen for more reasons than an anti-war movement that those wars end, that people come home because there's other ways of doing things. So the state security apparatus we're talking about that people debate in Congress, that people are worried about, people see happening, that's something that is not about just right and left. It's about a lot of people in America who have these kind of concerns and thoughts, and that's something we haven't touched on yet this evening. Dan?
Well, I agree. you've got an entrenched set of interests and institutions, all of which are constantly pushing, constantly creating a pressure for, even if you end these wars, you're going to have another set come along. That, again, is why I think it's important to look at the kind of historical depth and continuity of U.S. foreign policy and the fact that, going back from before, the Cold War all the way through to today and what you can envision coming down the line in 10 years' time, there's always got to be some sort of threat out there. There always has to be, this absolutely imperative need for the United States to go out and not only defend its own borders, defend its own interests, but actually to police the world and prevent any kind of possible development outside of what we like. I mentioned Andrew Bacevich's book, American Empire, and he talks about the open door. He's drawing on people like Charles Adams Beard and William Appleman Williams in devising this theory. This idea that America wants to have openness, whether it's markets, whether it's democracy along the lines that Americans are used to, that America has, feels this kind of imperative to create these kinds of structures in other countries, or else we feel that our own liberties will somehow be endangered. And all of this flows into the American ideology of exceptionalism, right? And that's something you've heard a lot of Republicans, even now, people like Marco Rubio in Florida talk about. There's something more here than just the material interests that are involved. There's something more here than just the entrenched bureaucracies that are constantly trying to replicate the wars they've fought in the past. There's also a very strong ideological and even religious component to this American crusading in the world.
I think that's how the neoconservatives got away with all they did during the run-up to the Iraq War. Because they made this an ideological thing in which there was this idea that our American exceptionalism was going to help spread democracy to a region of the world that was fighting an Islamic insurgency, one that was not only threatening us, so to speak, but threatening their own people and people throughout the world. And they were able to put this in a context in which we were the savior of the world. And we had Bush, I think it was in his 2004 inaugural address, talking about this, about the exceptionalism, about the fact that he was going to use American power to spread democracy in other parts of the world that didn't have it. And so they were able to frame this so that the American people felt that this was a World War II, where we were going to save people, and we were going to be that shining city on the hill. And I think that most people see that as a bunch of malarkey at this point, after seeing all of the destruction, the death, the refugees that still haven't returned, the torture, that wasn't the real reason for the war. But I think Dan's right, that this was the ideological.
But there's also the issue of many people theorize now that you are going to see the kinds of wars we're talking about, and being people oppose diminish because the means of fighting those wars are going to change. Use less troops, use drones, use assassinations, use other ways of addressing a war that don't cost the same, but are also tied into a much larger security apparatus. You saw the trials taking place with Drake in Baltimore. Again, opening up what's happening at NSA, spying on American citizens. I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
But that kind of overarching apparatus really is growing, and it's only now just bubbling the surface in terms of our public conversation.
I think that we should be warned about that. I think the media has established the framework for this, you know, the next debate. Is it, are we willing to keep resourcing massive counterinsurgency and a nation-building exercise in Afghanistan, or do we go with the so-called Biden, you know, plan where we resource special forces to go out there and kill our enemies and target our enemies using, you know, it's intelligence, the CIA, and these predator drone attacks? What I think the anti-war movement needs to, on the left and the right, is to hold fast that this is intervention, whether you're dropping bombs from the sky or you're shooting people in the streets. So we have to be firm to make sure that we keep the debate on the intervention itself. We need to get out of Iraq. It's not about, you know, how small of a footprint. We should have no footprint. And I think that we've, you know, that is the challenge, is getting on the media, getting out there, getting the message across that this isn't about the footprint. It's about getting out, period, that this intervention, you know, the Predator drones, it's been proven all along that that's creating more al-Qaeda, more enemies, more jihadists. So it's not a matter of how you're killing these people. It's the fact that we're killing them.
There are very different ideas about what America... how we deal with debt, deficit, jobs, how to create our vision of America for the 21st century, between right and left, between Ron Paul or between Dennis Kucinich or John Conyers or any number of people we can mention. They're very different visions of what that means.
Right.
So when you're organizing to kind of end these wars, we're also talking about what kind of America comes home. So how do you organize across those lines when there are very, very, very real differences about what America should look like and how it should get there?
Well, let's stay with the theme, which is anti-war, et cetera. How many people know that if 300 people ask for a meeting with their member of Congress and sign individually on a petition, the chances are they'll have a meeting back home with their member of Congress? Is that too much to ask? Once you get that member in the room, then things start building. These people live in bubbles. They have their own newsletters, their own radio stations coming out of Congress, and they have single-member districts, single-party districts, gerrymandered districts. They have their own funders. They don't feel the heat. 300 people. My experience is 300 people or more will get you a meeting in an auditorium with a member of Congress. Then you can choreograph it and build on it, and you get more and more on a mailing list. A lot of people, they escape through their own sense of futility, and they become very good at rationalizing their own futility. Even people who are really red hot against the war, you say, have you called or spoken or written to your member of Congress? I can't do it. It won't make any difference. Well, you think it's a coincidence that most of the anti-war members of Congress happen to come from districts that have a high propensity to be against war, except Walter Jones? How come? Is that just an obvious accidental correlation that Conyers and Kucinich and people from near Seattle or Cambridge happen to be more anti-war? They're reflecting what they think is the mood. In fact, they're there because of the mood of the people, which isn't even focused in a laser beam effort, as it certainly could be, with very minimal effort, if people didn't rationalize their own futility.
Well, you know, maybe that's the idea right there. I mean, if the left and right started working together, where people who are active in their communities put aside some of the differences that they might have over Medicare and social issues and maybe say, hey, let's get together and let's bring our member here to talk about the war. And maybe then, if you have this, you know, wave of town hall meetings and meetings that are getting media coverage, you know, like the anti-Obamacare hearings that we saw, was it last summer or the summer before, where you had town hall meeting after town hall meeting, and the corporate media loved it. They gobbled it up because there they have all this footage of citizens waving their fists and screaming at their members of Congress. And, you know, it was, you know, it was a big hubbaloo, and they were able to, you know, they were actually able to affect, you know, the health care debate, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know. And I don't see the same thing happening, for, you know, in the anti-war movement. And that might be because the corporate media doesn't like the anti-war meeting, and maybe they won't even cover these town hall meetings if you were even be able to get them, you know, scheduled. I don't know. But maybe it's worth trying if you get both sides together to bring the numbers together, if they just get, you know, on that one issue, the anti-war issue. I don't know.
So you want me to stop talking about the differences? I will just for a minute, though. Yeah.
Well, and you have the ideal issue to do it on right now with Libya, because clearly, you know, the parts of the anti-war movement that were sincere back during the Bush years are still very angry about what's happening in Libya right now under Obama. You also have a lot of conservatives, Republicans, and, you know, people generally on the right who may or may not even have very well-formed ideas about some, you know, foreign policy topics, but who don't like the fact that Obama has been utterly egregious and not even, you know, going through the formality of asking Congress for, you know, an unconstitutional authorization for his war. So I think you could really get an enormous just populist turnout. They wouldn't be right, left. They could be both, and a lot of other people too, to come together and really lobby their congressman very hard about what's going on in Libya and get some actual really results on that.
Actually, you should look up the lawsuit that was just filed last week by Walter Jones and Dennis Kucinich. There are five Republicans and five Democrats. It's really a brief. It's a wonderful series of arguments about the illegality and inadvisability and unconstitutional nature of the Libyan effort. And it was brought together by their lawyer, Professor Jonathan Turley, at George Washington University Law School. So it's, I'm sure it's online. Anybody know where, Kevin? Do you know?
Google.
Oh, okay.
Ralph doesn't use a computer, so.
I fell into that one.
Well, is there a question here before we go on? Go ahead.
All right. Hey, how you doing? Listen, we've gone over a lot of great ideas here and figured out what's going on and everything, but the problem I'm seeing is this traditional American mentality of, well, war, all these terrible things going on. This is the price of freedom. This is the price you have to pay for your life. And I'm wondering how we can, and this is particularly for the people on the right, because I think it's people on the right who have those beliefs. How can we, I don't think we're going to get too far until we can start to break that down, show that, no, this is not the price of freedom. You don't have to endure all these things to have freedom and justice and everything like that. And how do we get through that mentality? Because I think that that is the big block to all the ideas that we're talking about here. Oh, it has to be this way because we're protecting freedom. War is protecting freedom. Now, how do we get through that?
All right, let's have some final thoughts. Kelly?
Okay, final thought is I think we can all agree that the media is a major, major obstacle in pushing our, you know, anti-war agenda forward. As for your comments about, you know, we don't see the impact on a daily basis, I think that this is an incredible success of the military messaging machine, which has managed to create a blackout of information coming from the war. So we don't see, you know, the impact of these bombs on the landscape there. We don't see the death, the destruction. We're not allowed to see photographs of injured soldiers and dead soldiers, or even we can see the coffins now after we have to fight for that, but we are basically in the dark in terms of what the, you know, what the impact is. And they've been extremely successful. And why? Because we have this corporate media that depends on the access to the military. And they're not going to do anything that's going to break that access or hurt that access. So the reporters that go over there as embeds get sucked into the machine, sucked into the hive, and they're basically there as surrogates of the media at this point. So we as Americans, I think that what we need to do is to bust through this corporate media, you know, Khyber Pass, if you will, and start supporting independent media, whether it be online, offline, or whatever. We need to start, you know, putting our, you know, the money where our mouth is and actually support independent media. So we could support reporters who go over there as non-embeds and can report to us the truth. And so that people, the American people, could see pictures and see what's really going on in our name. And then maybe they'll have a visceral reaction to it and then say, no way, this can't be. For 10 years, we thought everything was about, you know, everything was going swell. We weren't seeing, you know, the crippling of the people over there. And, you know, I think that's where we need to start.
Go ahead. Ralph Nader.
First, a footnote. The California Nurses Association is starting a website on protests. So all the protests around the country you never hear about, you'll have round-the-clock videos of various protests that are occurring on all kinds of domestic and international issues. Second is, George Soros, for $200 million, could have stopped the war in Iraq. Already, there were 300 prominent retired military, diplomatic, and national security officials who stood up against the war. General Zinni, Admiral Shanahan, retired General Odom, the two chief advisors to the first George Bush, Brent Scowcroft and Jim Baker. But they weren't organized. They didn't have a secretariat. They didn't have a media behind them. And so they did their op-ed, then they went back, frustrated. He was dead set against the war. He wrote books. He spoke, George Soros. He makes about $2 to $3 billion a year. We've got to convince rich people of enlightened background to pour the money into the anti-war effort. Because if you had another 1,000 organizers, you had another 5,000 lecturers, if you had national media, we wouldn't be sitting here desperately seeking some sort of turnaround mechanism. So always think of that. The more we turn out, the more we have rallies, the more it'll come to the attention of one or two or three of these billionaires. Yeah, it's really worth putting big money behind it. Look at the Koch brothers on the other side.
Dan McCarthy.
Well, I agree with Ralph. In fact, you do need a great deal of money, and as much as can be done with grassroots financing, finding, you know, a few very wealthy individuals who believe in this issue and are willing to, you know, put their money where their beliefs are is crucial. As far as the very good question we had from the gentleman over there about how you shake Americans out of this myth that the price we pay for freedom is empire abroad, basically, it really is a matter of education, but it's education of, you know, the hard cases, right? So many people on the left are accustomed to thinking about that already. It's a matter of going to people on the right and being able to speak their language and communicate to them, and people, you know, in the center, people from Middle America, from the Midwest, and not turning them off too quickly by, you know, throwing out something that they will find extremely objectionable, whether it's saying that deficits don't matter or whatever the case might be. It's a matter of going to them and talking to them where they are and where they are philosophically first, and leading them on to a view of how our military industrial security apparatus is completely counterproductive. And in fact, I mean, there is this great American tradition, right? And in fact, it's even arguably a conservative tradition, going back, you know, to the founding of this country, which was extremely skeptical of standing military establishments.
That's right.
This tradition has been completely obliterated by basically a media apparatus that has deliberately, you know, done this. You can reawaken people to this history and this heritage, and it's something that resonates very strongly with conservatives. I mean, this is a Jeffersonian tradition. So that's, I think, the approach I take. And I know it's a very difficult uphill battle because you are trying to educate people against what they've been taught in public schools, what they've been taught in corporate media, what they've been taught, you know, even through the, you know, their churches, through their military systems. All kinds of things in this country institutionally have been corrupted and co-opted by this power establishment, by this imperial mindset. But it can be fought, and it can be fought at a grassroots level. It is like another American Revolution in that you approach it wherever you find it, and you do what you can, you know, always having this sense of sympathy with your fellow citizens, right? You don't demonize them as being leftists or being right-wingers or whatever it might be. You approach them where they are, and you try to work them out of that and show them actually what the historical truth about this country and the military-industrial state really has been.
Kevin Zeiss.
I'll finish where I began. Militarism and empire are deeply embedded in this culture. I think we are seeing it now turn in on itself. As Ralph said earlier, empires fail and end up eating their own. We're seeing that now. Everyone is paying a price for this military empire, not just those who serve in the poverty draft, but also all of us with the austerity budgets, with the lousy economy, with the rapidly rising deficits. All that has its roots in American empire. American empire is getting more and more costly and less effective for the home front, and more are going to see it. That's an opportunity for us. It's an opportunity for us to educate, organize, and mobilize. And so I'd urge people to get involved. ComeHomeAmerica.us is trying to bring right and left together. And in October, the October2011.org effort is trying to bring people out into the streets, into Freedom Plaza, and to show the people in Washington, D.C. that we're not going to take it anymore. We're going to stand up and demand an end to the business as usual. So join us in October2011.org and ComeHomeAmerica.us. Thank you all very much.
Kevin Zeese, Kelly Vlahos, Ralph Nader, Dan McCarthy, thank you all for being here. Thank Busboy and Boats for staying open tonight for us to have this. Thank all of you for coming out on Father's Day. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.